This week is our last study of the Old Testament. We've been marching through the Old Testament for the last year, and next week we move into the first of 2 years of dealing with the New Testament, the Gospel, as it was fulfilled by Jesus Christ. Actually, next week we will cover what happened between the Old Testament and the New Testament period, so you'll want to be here for that. But today we're going to wrap it up. The last few weeks we've seen that the southern nation of Judah has been exiled in Babylon, and the Babylonians were then conquered by the Persians, and we saw last week that the Persians then allowed the Jews to go back. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is the return of Judah back from captivity in Babylon to Judah, to Jerusalem. And we see most of the stories of this in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which actually were the same book. It was one book. Some places even call them First Ezra or First Esdras. Esdras is the Greek name for Ezra, and Second Ezra or Second Esdras. But originally it was all one book, and we've got it split up into two here. So let's just dive in. We see that in Nehemiah chapter 9, there's a few chapters scattered through the Bible. We've seen 2 Kings 17, we've seen some in Jeremiah. Nehemiah 9 is another example. Stephen's speech in Acts is another example where we get a good Reader's Digest version of the history of Israel, the history of God's people. And Nehemiah 9 is one of those. It's a big prayer that where the Israelites are confessing their sins, and it gives a big story of the Israelites. So we won't be able in our class today to read this because of time, but let's just kind of pick a few verses out of it that remind us why the Jews had been exiled to Babylon in the first place. So Nehemiah chapter 9 verse 16 says, "But they, our forefathers," he's talking about, "became arrogant and stiff-necked and did not obey your commands." Again, this is a prayer to God. So our forefathers did not obey God's commands, did not obey your commands. And then moving on to verse 29, "You warned them to return to your law, but they became arrogant and disobeyed your commands. They sinned against your ordinances, by which a man will live if he obeys them. Stubbornly, they turned their backs on you, became stiff-necked, and refused to listen. For many years you were patient with them. By your spirit you admonished them through your prophets, yet they paid no attention. So you handed them over to the neighboring peoples. But in your great mercy, you did not put an end to them or abandon them, for you are a gracious and merciful God." So because Israel, and they claimed our forefathers, because our forefathers were unfaithful, did not follow you as you guided them, they stubbornly turned their backs on you, became stiff-necked, refused to listen. You were very patient with them. Take a look at how many years the nations lasted and how many times God continued to send prophets to call them back to Him. And yet, it says they paid no attention. So you handed them over to their neighboring peoples, but you didn't abandon them. They were not abandoned. They were exiled, but not abandoned. And I kind of look at it as they spent 70 years in a think about it chair in Babylon. Because what you see and what we'll see, especially we'll get more into it next week when we talk about what happened between the Testaments, but we see it here with Ezra and to a degree with Nehemiah, that their return came back with a new vigored faith, a new faithfulness that they were serious about. Okay. Well, while the Jews were in Babylon, they were comforted by something. There was something that God had told them through Isaiah and elsewhere too, but that they kind of hung on to. So if you look at Isaiah chapter 13, it says this is an oracle concerning Babylon that Isaiah saw. And looking at verse 17, God says, "See, I will stir up against them the Medes." Okay, the Medes and the Persians. The Persians were right next door to the Medes. This is all Iran, the Medo-Persia. "Who do not care for silver and have no delight in gold. Babylon, the jewel of kingdoms, the glory of the Babylonians' pride, will be overthrown by God, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. The Lord will have compassion on Jacob. Once again, He will choose Israel and settle them in their own land. aliens will join them and unite with the house of Jacob. So God would bring vengeance against the Babylonians for what they've done to the Israelites in destroying and killing off many of them, destroying their land, destroying their city, Jerusalem, the temple, and bringing them into exile. And God would do that through the Persians and bring the Persians. He told, this is Isaiah, this is well before the Babylonians ever even attacked. Isaiah was around when the Assyrians were the big world power and were destroying the northern nation of Israel. So they had that prophecy way back then that they hung on to, that the Persians would come and rescue, basically rescue Israel, that Israel would be returned after Persia conquered Babylon. Did they have any idea how long they would have to wait for this to happen? You know, they knew exactly how long. In Jeremiah 29, they had a prophecy, starting at verse 10. This is what Yahweh says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you, and I'll fulfill my gracious promise to bring you back to this place. Jeremiah was speaking from Jerusalem. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares Yahweh, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. And then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I'll listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart, just like Jesus says, seek and you will find. I will be found by you, declares Yahweh, and I will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares Yahweh, and I will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile. So they had the promise that a remnant would return. And this remnant would return after 70 years of exile. So they knew exactly how long it would take. In fact, Daniel, who we saw, he was blessed by God, and the story that we have of Daniel was while he was there in Babylon, in the Babylonian captivity, and he lived a long life, and so he was there from the exile of the Jews to Babylon all the way through the Persians taking over. And so he was there for the full 70 years. And so you see when that 70 years came up, Daniel chapter 9 is his response. It says here, in the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes, who was a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood from the scriptures, according to the word of Yahweh given to Jeremiah the prophet, that the desolation of Jerusalem would last 70 years. So I turned to the Lord God and pleaded with him in prayer and petition, in fasting, and in sackcloth and ashes. And then he goes on with a big prayer. So Daniel remembered, and he prayed to God as that 70 years neared, as the Persians came in and conquered the Babylonians, and he saw that the time was near, he prayed to God and prayed to God for deliverance, prayed and fasted for God to return the Jews back to the land that he had originally given them. Okay? So we have the story then of that happening in the very last two verses of Second Chronicles, which then feeds into the first three verses, or first two verses of Ezra, which happen to be pretty close to the same verses, so you could read it from either one. And we see the story of that, Ezra chapter 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, now Darius was the king of the Medes who came in, and what happened to defeat the Babylonians, the Persians and the Medes joined forces. And Darius the Mede was the one who came in to Babylon and took over. But then when he passed on, then Cyrus the Persian then took over. Okay. So in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of Yahweh spoken to Jeremiah, Yahweh moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and to put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. So you see that even Cyrus, the king of the Persians, recognized that Yahweh had appointed him, had called him to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. So God was responsible for sending the Jews back to Judah, and he did so through Cyrus, the king of Persia. Well, now it's been 70 years. Well, there aren't many people who are still around. The people who came into exile, most of them have died off. In fact, you know, 40 is a good round number for generations, so you've got their grandkids and maybe even some great-grandkids around at this time. So these people have been there for this long. Most of the Jews, all that they've known in their lives is Babylon, is where they live. So they aren't returning to what they remember. They're returning to the land that was of the Jews. So who decided to go after being settled for 70 years? Who gave up their homes that they were living in for all these years and returned back to Jerusalem? Verse 3, this is Cyrus's edict continuing. Any one of his people among you, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem and Judah and build the temple of Yahweh, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of Yahweh in Jerusalem. So, who went? Not everybody, but everyone whose heart God had moved. So we have a sifting here to get the most faithful, and the most faithful people are the ones that gave up everything, kind of like Abraham did, and went back to Jerusalem, which was totally devastated. There was nothing there waiting them other than ruins. And so they went back to rebuild the temple and to rebuild the Jewish nation here. Now these people had been servants to the Babylonians and Persians. How could they afford their travel expenses and whatever expense they're going to have when they get there to build a home, living expenses, because there's no crops for them to live off of, plus, you know, temple construction and all that. How would they afford all this? Verse 6. All of their neighbors assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with valuable gifts, in addition to all the freewill offerings. So the people that the Jews lived around, when they left Persia and went to Judah, their neighbors gave them gifts and gave them the funds, money, livestock, etc. And why did they do that? Well, partly because we skipped verse 3, but that was part of Cyrus's edict, that people were to support them like this. In addition to this group of Jews going back, Cyrus sent some other stuff back. And what was that? Verse 7. Moreover, King Cyrus brought out the articles belonging to the temple of Yahweh, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed in the temple of his God. So Nebuchadnezzar had taken these and put these in the temple. These are some of the same articles that were the goblets that Belshazzar had taken out and was drinking toast to other gods the day when he was killed by the Persians. And so Cyrus took these and gave them over to the Jews going back to take back to put into this temple that they were rebuilding. How much did they bring back? Verse 8. Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought by Mithridat, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And this was the inventory, and it gives the inventory. In all, there were 5,400 articles of gold and of silver. Sheshbazzar brought all of these along when the exiles came up from Babylon to Jerusalem. Okay, so 5,400 gold and silver items. So a lot of weight, but a lot of value here. A lot of value that had come from the temple before. Now, it mentions he gave these to Sheshbazzar. Who was Sheshbazzar? It says he was the prince of Judah. And if you look at the 1 Chronicles 3, Ezra 5, 2, and 14 to 16, and also Haggai, and many other places in here, you'll see that this guy has two names. He's named Sheshbazzar, and he's also named Zerubbabel. Okay, Zerubbabel. And if you look at those, you will see that he was Jehoiachin's grandson. Jehoiachin was the king in the first exile of Judah. He was a descendant of David. And so his grandson, Zerubbabel, or Sheshbazzar, was sent back and sent to be the governor of Judah by the Persians. Okay, So you still have that royalty line continuing here. There are some disagreements to whether Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel were the same person. I think a lot of things point to that they were. And we've already seen in our stories in the last few weeks how many people had two names. Many Jews had a Hebrew name and had a Babylonian or a Persian name. And that, I think, is probably what we're dealing with here. We also see Zerubbabel later in Matthew 1 and in Luke 3 in Jesus' lineage. Matthew 1 gives us a lineage through Joseph. Luke 3 gives us a lineage through Mary. And you see Zerubbabel in those. Okay. Well, how many Jews returned with this? Well, that's what you see in chapter 2. And you can go through and just read this total tabulation. If you add them all up, you get it in chapter 2 gives us a summary. Verse 1, it says, "Now these are the people of the province who came up from the captivity of the exiles, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had taken captive to Babylon. And then they returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own town." And then verse 64, "The whole company numbered 42,360, besides their 7,337 men servants and maid servants, and they also had 200 men and women singers. They had 736 horses, 245 mules, 435 camels, and 6,720 donkeys." So this was the entourage that went back to Judah. Over 42,000 plus 7,500 servants that went there. This was in 537 B.C. We talked a little bit about timeline last week, but that kind of gives you about 500 years, a little bit over 500 years before Jesus came is when all this happened. All right, so the Jews went back. When they arrived, in verse 68 of chapter 2, it says that some of the heads of the families gave freewill offerings towards the rebuilding of the temple of God on its site. And then they go and they settle themselves in their towns, okay, in verse 70. They settled in their own towns, and we see that 3 months later, okay, they arrived in the fourth month, and in the seventh month had come, chapter 3, verse 1, the Israelites had settled in their towns. The people assembled as one man in Jerusalem. Then Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his associates began to build the altar of God of the God of Israel to sacrifice burnt offerings on it, in accordance with what was written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So they all came together after being gone for 3 months and came together and built the altar so that they could start doing sacrifices. Now, this happened in the seventh month, which is called Tishri in their calendar. And that's kind of a special month. It's kind of the most important month. And you see that back in Leviticus chapter 23. And we see three different things. In verse 24, it says, "Say to the Israelites, on the first day of the seventh month, you're to have a day of rest, a sacred assembly commemorated with trumpet blasts." Okay? So it started out the month with trumpet blasts. And then, verse 27, "The tenth day of this seventh month is the Day of Atonement. Hold a sacred assembly and deny yourself and present an offering made to Yahweh by fire." The Day of Atonement was when the great high priest would go into the most holy place and make atonement, that means at one, being made at one, for the whole nation, okay, for all people. That was the one day of the year when anyone would go into the most holy place, and it was always the great high priest. And then, verse 34, "Say to the Israelites, on the 15th day of the seventh month, the Lord's Feast of Tabernacles begins, and it lasts for 7 days." So the first day was the Feast of Trumpets, the 10th day was the Day of Atonement, and then from the 15th day for the next 7 days was the Feast of Tabernacles, where they lived for a week in tents and tabernacles to remind them of how the Israelites had lived in the wilderness for 40 years. Okay? So they came together and built the altar in Jerusalem during this month. Okay? And they built the altar. They started conducting sacrifices on that altar, even though there was no temple yet. Okay? And then what did they do? Verse 8. "In the second month of the second year after their arrival at the house of God in Jerusalem, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and the rest of their brothers, the priests and the Levites, and all who had been returned from the captivity to Jerusalem, began the work, appointing Levites 20 years of age in order to supervise the building of the house of Yahweh. So they started rebuilding the temple. And what's the first thing you do is you set the foundations. Okay, and we see that in the next verses. When the builders lay the foundation of the temple of Yahweh, the priests in their vestments and with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, took their places to praise Yahweh as prescribed by David, the king of Israel. With praise and thanksgiving they sang to Yahweh, He is good, and His love to Israel endures forever. And all the people gave a great shout of praise to Yahweh because the foundation of the house of Yahweh was laid. But many of the older priests and the Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple, so these would be pretty old at this time, wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid, while many others shouted for joy. No one could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping, because the people made so much noise, and the sound was heard far away. So this was an exciting time. It was a thrilling time that the temple, the foundations had been laid, and they're moving towards building the temple. And there was much shouts of joy from the people as they did this. You see, the people who remembered the temple in its prior glory before it was destroyed, they wept aloud for the loss of that, but also wept aloud out of happiness that it was going to be rebuilt. Now, the Jews received some offer for help, we see in chapter 4. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for Yahweh, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, Hey, let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. So their neighbors to the north, the people in the old nation of Israel, the northern nation of Israel, the people who lived in the land that was called Samaria. These people would be called Samaritans. And they wanted to help. They say, Hey, we sacrifice to your God too. We worship your God, so we want to help you build the temple. Okay? And we've been worshiping your God ever since the Assyrians brought us here. Well, were these people Israelites? And were they following Jehovah as the one true God? Well, 2 Kings chapter 17 answers that question. That takes us back to when these people came into play. Verse 22, it says that the Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until Yahweh removed them from his presence as he had warned through all his servants the prophets. So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they are still there. So the Israelites in the northern nation of Israel were taken out of Israel and scattered in Assyria. And they're still there. Okay, they intermixed with the people. They never came back. So the people that are offering to help the Jews are not these people. So who are they? Verse 24. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the Israelites. They took over Samaria and lived in its towns. So these people were people from other nations. These were not Israelites in any way, shape, or form. These were other people that the Assyrians had conquered, and just as they scattered the Jews in other territories, they took people of other territories and brought them and resettled them into Israel. So these were not Israelites. Verse 28. One of the priests who had been exiled from Samaria came to live in Bethel and taught the Samaritans how to worship Yahweh. So even though they weren't Israelites, some of them started being eaten by lions and bears and stuff like that, which you see in verse 25, they decided, well, we need to learn how to worship the God of the land. The concept was that every land had its own God, and when you went to a particular land, you needed to worship the God of that land. So they went and found one of the priests of the Israelites that had been exiled and brought him back to teach the other people how to worship the God of the land. And it says here that he taught them how to worship Yahweh. But did he teach them how to worship Yahweh? Actually, the kind of worship that the northern kingdom of Israel recognized and that they called Yahweh worship was not Yahweh worship. It was worship of Jeroboam's religion. If you remember, Jeroboam was the first king of the northern nation of Israel, and he didn't want his people to go to Jerusalem to worship Yahweh, so he made up his own religion, set up his own temples, set up golden calves, made up his own festivals, set up his own priests, all of that. And that is what this priest would have taught them how to worship. Not Yahweh, even though they said it was Yahweh, it wasn't. Okay, so it was a very polluted form of Yahweh worship. It was really Jeroboam religion worship. And then on top of that, verse 33, it says that these people worshipped Yahweh, at least the Jeroboam form, but they also served their own gods in accordance with the customs of the nations from which they had been brought. So they did not worship Yahweh as the one true God. Okay? They really didn't. Their worship of Yahweh was polluted, and they worshipped their own gods as well. So they really weren't Israelites. They really were not worshiping Yahweh as the one true God. So they, when they offered to help, did the Jews accept their help? Verse 3. But Zerubbabel, this is back in Ezra chapter 4, but Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for Yahweh, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us." So, no, you're not pure Israelites. You're not Israelite at all. You're not worshiping our God. We are going to build a temple for our God. And besides, the king said so. Okay? The king only said us. Well, the Samaritans, how do they feel about their help being rejected, their offer for help? Verse 4, then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and to make them afraid to go on building. They hired counselors to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So they did everything they could to make things difficult for the Israelites, for the Jews trying to build this temple. They even got lawyers involved and tried to find ways to stop them through the lawyers. And you see that they made it difficult and interfered with their progress all the reign of Cyrus through the reign of Darius. Now, this is not the same Darius that we saw last week or 2 weeks ago that conquered the Babylonians. If you turn to page 4 of your handout, you'll see towards the bottom a timeline of the Persian rulers. And you can see Darius Cyaxares II that's the Darius that we talked about with Daniel in the book of Daniel, the one that conquered the Babylonians. Then you have after him was Cyrus II, or Cyrus II the Great, and he was the one who issued the decree of restoration that sent the Jews to come back and build the temple. So from his reign, all through the reign of Cambyses II through Darius I, all that time, it says, they frustrated the plans, frustrated the work on building the temple. Well, what happened as a result of this opposition? Verse 24. Thus the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. So the Samaritans were successful in stopping the Israelites and interfering with them enough to get them to stop building the temple. And it stopped. And it stopped for years. And then God raised up a couple of prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. These are a couple of the last books. The very last book in the Old Testament is Malachi, but the next two are Haggai and Zechariah. And they both came during the second year of Darius, really for the same purpose, which we'll just kind of look at a few verses in Haggai to get the point. Chapter 1. In the second year of King Darius, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of Yahweh came through the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Okay, so there we see the people we've been seeing before. Joshua and Jeshua are the same person. This is what Yahweh Almighty says. These people say, the time has not yet come for Yahweh's house to be built. So that's why they're not building the house, right? Then the word of Yahweh came through the prophet Haggai. is it a time for you yourselves to be living in your paneled houses while this house remains a ruin? We're moving on to verse 7. This is what Yahweh Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. Go up into the mountains and bring down timber and build the house so that I may take pleasure in it and be honored, says Yahweh. So they dallied. They allowed themselves, their efforts to rebuild the temple, to be frustrated by the Samaritans, and so they stopped. And so God then woke them up by sending Haggai and Zechariah to get them to build his temple, to remind them of their calling to build the temple. So did the people listen to these prophets? Ezra chapter 5. Now Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet, descendant of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, set to work to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem. And the prophets of God were with them, helping them. So yes, the Jews began working on the temple again. Well, the Samaritans were still there. Okay, the Samaritans had frustrated their efforts so far. Just because a couple prophets come in, they're starting to rebuild, we need to stop it again, right? So what kind of opposition do they meet again here? Verse 3, at that time, Tattenai, the governor of Trans-Euphrates means across Euphrates, that means the land east of west of the Euphrates here. So he was a governor, and Shethar-Bozenai and their associates went to the Jews and asked, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and restore this structure? They also asked, hey, what are the names of the men who are constructing this building? But the eye of their God was watching over the elders of the Jews, and they were not stopped until a report could go to Darius and his written reply be received. Okay, and then verse 6 says, this is a copy of the letter that they sent. The report sent him read as follows. To King Darius, cordial greetings. Going on to zoom into verse 17. It talks about stuff, and then it says, now if it pleases the king, let a search be made in the royal archives of Babylon to see if King Cyrus did in fact issue a decree to rebuild this house of God in Jerusalem. Then let the king send us his decision in this manner. So the Samaritans are thinking, hey, these guys are just doing this on their own. So they send a letter to the king and say, hey, these guys say that they have the right to do this, that Cyrus gave a decree that said that they could come rebuild this temple, but we don't believe them. So please search the records and find out, and because that was 2 kings ago, and find out and let us know whether they have the right to do this or we should stop them. Okay. So he searched the records, chapter 6. It says, King Darius then issued an order, and they searched in the archives stored in the treasury at Babylon. A scroll was found in the citadel of Ecbatana in the province of Media, and this was written on it. So he found something. Okay, he searched the records, and he found what you see in the next verses is the edict that Cyrus issued there at the beginning of Ezra. Okay, so he said, "Yep, they do have this command." And in addition to that, he added an extra touch. It says, verse 6, he tells Tattenai and Shethar-Bozenai and their fellow officials of that province, stay away from there. Leave them alone. Let them do their stuff. Do not interfere with the work on this temple of God. Let the governor of the Jews and the Jewish elders rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I hereby decree what you're to do for these elders of the Jews in the construction of this house of God. The expenses of this men are to be fully paid out of the royal treasury from the revenues of Trans-Euphrates, so that the work will not stop. So he kind of comes back, and they never should have asked in the first place, obviously, but they asked. He found that, yes, it was an edict, and he said, okay, you're going to leave them alone and let them do this, but in addition to that, you're going to pay for it. You're going to pay whatever expenses they have in doing this so that they can get this job done. It's going to come out of your budget, come out of your funds. Okay? So you can see that just makes the Samaritans even more upset, right? But they have the king's command to leave them alone and to let them build this. So they do. Well, what did the Jews do after the temple's finished? Well, what do you expect they would do? Verse 15, the temple was completed on the third day of the month Adar in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. So we see how long it took them to build that. Then the people of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles celebrated the dedication of the house of God with joy. As you would expect, the temple is built, and so they celebrate it. They have a big dedication. The next verses you see, they offer a ton of sacrifices, okay? As you would expect, as they've done when they've had other major dedications like this. And then verse 19, on the 14th day of the first month, the exiles celebrated the Passover. So they dedicated the temple and they celebrated the Passover in 515 BC. So the temple was built, okay? That's step one. Well, what's the next step? Well, they need to rebuild Jerusalem, okay? They probably cleaned up some of the mess there, but they need to rebuild the protection of Jerusalem. It's a sitting duck. Anybody can come in and invade until they get walls. So they need to rebuild the city walls. Well, they'd had opposition when they built the temple. Did they see any opposition when they tried to build the city walls? Go back to chapter 4, verse 6 is where we see that. And this is under the reign of Xerxes. At the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, they lodged, that is, the Samaritans lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem. So yes, under Xerxes, okay, and you can see Xerxes on your chart, he's the one who came after Darius. He's the next king in line. This is also the king that we saw last week who married Esther. And during the time that the Jews were almost annihilated by Haman. Okay. So under Xerxes, the Samaritans again tried to thwart the Jews' efforts. Okay. Well, they couldn't get Xerxes to stop the construction. Okay. They brought an accusation, but Xerxes didn't do anything about it. So, what did they do next? We'll go to verse 11. They sent a letter to King Artaxerxes. Well, if you look again at page 4, Artaxerxes followed Xerxes. So, after Xerxes was gone, they had given up on him, and so then they, when there's a new king in place, Artaxerxes, they wrote a letter to him, you see in verse 7. And here's the letter in verse 11. From your servants, the men of Trans-Euphrates, the king should know that Jews who came up to us from you have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that wicked and rebellious city. They are restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if this city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes, tribute, or duty will be paid, and the royal revenues will suffer. Okay? So they kind of make up a story to try to make sure that they're going to get the king's attention. What does the king care about? He cares about treason. He cares about people breaking off, people rebelling. He cares about people not paying their taxes, about the revenues being reduced. So that's, they make up this story and say, this is a wicked and rebellious city, and, you know, they're trying to rebuild it so they can rebel again, and, you know, you really ought to look at the records, and if you, in verse 15, we recommend that you might want to make a search of the archives of your predecessors, and you'll find that this city is a wicked and rebellious city. Okay? That's why the city was destroyed in the first place, and that's why they're having to rebuild it. So, what did Artaxerxes do? Verse 19, he wrote a reply back. He said, I issued an order and a search was made, and it was found that this city has a long history of revolt against kings. And it's been a place of rebellion and sedition. Now, issue an order to these men to stop work so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Okay? So he agreed with them, and he ordered the reconstruction of the walls to stop. Okay? And so that happened under Artaxerxes. He commanded that the reconstruction of the walls to be stopped. And then we go on later in the book, or we move to the next book called Nehemiah, which had originally been part of the book of Ezra. It was just, but they split it in half here. And we see the story of Nehemiah. And who was Nehemiah? Chapter 2, verse 1, it says, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. Okay? So Nehemiah served King Artaxerxes. He was, in the last verse of chapter 1, it says, I was cupbearer to the king. So he was a very trusted servant of the king Artaxerxes. He was a cupbearer because being a cupbearer had to make sure that the wine, the drink, whatever he was drinking was good to drink and there was no poison in it. That was an easy way to get rid of somebody, was to poison their drink. And so the cupbearer had to be a very trusted individual, and Nehemiah was. Okay, he was a Jew that was serving the king. Well, it says, going on, it says, I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you're not even sick? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. Well, Nehemiah was afraid to say something to the king, but he said, well, you know, why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Well, the king said to me, well, what is it that you want? Well, then I prayed to the God of heaven. He was afraid, so he prayed to God first before he answered. And I answered the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it. So he asked for permission and authority to go and rebuild Jerusalem city walls. Okay, he couldn't just build it himself, but he asked for the power of the king, the authority of the king, to go and get the people to rebuild the walls. Right now, Artaxerxes had issued this command for the construction to stop, but now a trusted servant is asking for permission to go rebuild these walls. So how did King Artaxerxes respond? Verse 6 says, then the king with the queen sitting beside him asked me, how long will your journey take and when will you get back? You see, he didn't ask a lot of questions. It was kind of a given. It's kind of like a, sure. Okay, when are you going to go, when are you going to get back kind of thing. So he says, it pleased the king to send me. So I set a time. And then I also said, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of the Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. Traveling was very dangerous. So he asked for protection. And may I have a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence that I'll occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my request. So I went to the governors of the Trans-Euphrates and I gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and a cavalry with me. Okay? So the king agreed and allowed him to go and gave him letters of support and military protection to get him there and to protect him there. So he goes to Jerusalem, and what does he do soon after he arrives in Jerusalem? Verse 15. So I went up the valley by night examining the wall. Okay, he said, nobody know. In verse 12 it says, I set out the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. Okay, there were no mounts riding with me except. So he went at night to go and survey the wall. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or the nobles or the officials or any others who would be doing the work. So he secretly inspected the city walls to see what kind of work was required. This is before he told anybody about it. And then he went to the Jews and told them what he was really there for. In verse 17, I said to them, you see the trouble that we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let's rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we'll no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, okay, let's start rebuilding. So they began this good work. So the Jews agreed, and they began the work. And chapter 3 gives us a breakdown of how he divided up the task and had work going on. This is a big wall, and had work going on the wall in many different places by many different crews. And that's what you see in chapter 3. Well, when the city walls were under construction, reconstruction before, we see that the Samaritans thwarted their efforts and got them to stop by having King Artaxerxes issue a decree to stop. Well, now King Artaxerxes had given Nehemiah the ability to come do this, so is there any opposition this second time around? Chapter 2, verse 10. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Okay, so they were upset that they were rebuilding this wall and that the Israelites were being supported. And then verse 19, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. "What is this you're doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" I answered them by saying, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it." So you see, when they approached him and threatened Nehemiah, he was bold. He stood, took a bold stand against them. He said, "You know, I'm not rebelling against the king. The king's given us authority, and we're going to do this. Our God has called us to do this. Our God is going to support us in this, and you have no share in this. You have no part in this." Well, then the wall started going up, and how did the Samaritans react? Chapter 4. When Sanballat heard that they were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What they're building? If even a fox climbed up on it, he'd break down their wall of stones." Okay, so they mocked him, and they ridiculed the Jews and their efforts of rebuilding this wall. And these guys were not professional wall builders. They didn't know what they were doing. There's no way their wall is not going to be able to stand up. But they work on, and they build this wall. And the wall reaches half of its height, and how do the Samaritans respond? Verse 6. "So we rebuilt the wall until all of it reached half of its height, for the people worked with all of their heart. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to stir up trouble against it." So they were threatened by a plan to attack and end the work here. Okay, our enemies also said in verse 11, "Before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them, and we will kill them and put an end to the work." Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." So the Jews heard about it, these plans to attack Jerusalem. Did that threat stop the efforts? Verse 16. "From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armors. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me." So they kept working. Even though they had this great threat of an army that would attack them, they had weapons, they had lookouts, they had people prepared to fight, but even the ones who were working had a weapon at their side, ready to defend any attack. So, Nehemiah resisted that opposition. So, he's pretty cunning, and he's doing a good job of resisting opposition. So, they try some other tactics. We see in chapter 6. In verse 2, it says that Sanballat Geshem sent me this message. This is Nehemiah talking. "Come, let's meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono." But they were scheming to harm me. Okay, so I sent messengers to them with this reply. "I'm carrying on a great project and I can't go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" Okay, 4 times they sent me the same message and each time I gave them the same answer. Okay, so they tried to draw Nehemiah out of town so they could harm him, capture him, kill him, something that would stop this effort. Okay, it's obviously going on and going on successfully because of his leadership, so let's get rid of the leader. Let's do something to stop the leader. That didn't work. Verse 5, "Then the fifth time Sanballat sent his aide to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter, in which was written, 'It's reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you're building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you're about to become their king, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem that there's a king in Judah. Now, this report, it might get back to the king, so come, let's confer together. Okay? So he's making up this story here of charging treason, really, to get him to come out and meet with him. Okay, Nehemiah says, I sent him this reply, nothing like what you're saying is happening. You're just making it up out of your head. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed. Now, strengthen my hands. Okay. So he thwarted that effort there too. And then verse 13. Well, let me go to start at verse 10. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Delaiah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in his home. He said, hey, let's meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let's close the temple doors because men are coming to kill you. By night they're coming to kill you. Okay, we can find safe haven in the temple. But who does that in the temple? Okay, nobody should go in the temple but priests, right? But I said, should a man like me run away? Or should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. So they tried to discredit him. They tried different ways to get at Nehemiah to stop him and therefore stop this construction of the walls. But none of it worked. And they kept building, and they kept building, and finally they finished the walls. How long did it take them? Verse 15. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. When all of our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. So it only took 52 days to rebuild this huge wall. And the only way that could be done, with all the threats that they had and all the opposition they had and with the lack of skills and all that, was to the glory of God. Okay? With God's help. And now that they were done, what did they do? Well, what do you expect that they did? They had a great celebration. Chapter 12 tells us a lot about this celebration. We'll just read a few scattered verses here. Verse 27. At the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, the Levites were sought out from where they lived and were brought to Jerusalem to celebrate joyfully the dedication with songs of thanksgiving and with the music of cymbals, harps, and lyres. Okay, so they got the musical priests together to come and play the music and to celebrate. Verse 31, I had the leaders of Judah go up on top of the wall. I also assigned two large choirs to give thanks. One of the choirs was to proceed on top of the wall to the right. Okay. And then, in verse 38, the second choir proceeded in the opposite direction, and I followed them on top of the wall together with half of the people. So he had these parades on top of the wall, these processionals on top of the wall that went both directions, and then they would meet on the other side. Okay. So this huge, huge celebration. Verse 40, the two choirs that gave thanks then took their places in the house of God, so did I, together with half of the officials. And then verse 43, and on that day they offered great sacrifices, rejoicing because God had given them great joy. The women and children also rejoiced. The sound of rejoicing in Jerusalem could be heard far away. So, big celebration, big dedication of the wall that God had helped them build. Well, now Jerusalem is protected. It now has a wall. But you know what? There's not many people there. Okay, most of the people lived in the surrounding towns and lived out in the country. And now there's a city, but there aren't any people living in there. And the homes are still ruins. They need to rebuild the homes. They need to turn it into a city. So what do? Chapter 11. Now the leaders of the people settled in Jerusalem, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring out one of every 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while the remaining 9 were to stay in their own towns. the people commended all the men who volunteered to live in Jerusalem. So they asked for volunteers of people to move to Jerusalem and to live there. And then they threw lots, they threw dice, they threw the pur, as we saw last week, to pick enough to get 10% of all the people, all the Jews that were in Judah, to move to and live in Jerusalem. And so that's how they populated the city. So now the city's built, the temple's built, but what else is missing? Well, we've got some priests and a few of the things there, but in chapter 12 gives us some of the priests and Levites and tells us that of those who came back with Zerubbabel. But are the people people of God? Well, that's where we get into Ezra. So we go back now to Ezra chapter 7 and pick up our story there. After these things, during the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, so you see, this is still Artaxerxes, the same king who was king with Nehemiah. And there is confusion and disagreement on whether Nehemiah came first or Ezra came first. The traditional view is that Ezra came before Nehemiah, and that's why it's kind of in this order. That's part of the reason they think that, but also there's a few other pointers to that. I covered Nehemiah first because we were talking about the city walls, and so I jumped there to finish on the city walls. But now we go back to Ezra chapter 7. And so we see that during the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra the son of Seraiah, okay, and we'll zoom on down, we'll skip all these names and go to verse 6, this Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a teacher well versed in the law of Moses, which Yahweh, the God of Israel, had given. The king granted him everything that he asked, for the hand of Yahweh his God was on him. So there we see Ezra during the time of Artaxerxes, and if you follow these names here, these names are tracing his lineage all the way to Aaron, who was the chief priest. So he was not only a Levite, a descendant of Levi, and the Levites were the priests, but he was descended from Aaron, the high priest. Okay, and so you see his lineage there. And you see that he was well-versed in the law of Moses and knew the law very well. So he was what would be called a scribe. The scribes were usually the ones who knew the Bible the best because they copied it. They were the Gutenberg. They were the printing press. They would hand copy to make copies of the scriptures. And in doing so, they would learn them and they would know them backwards and forwards, every letter, every dot, all of that, so that they could make sure that they got it right. And so we see that Artaxerxes sent him to Jerusalem. Okay, this is about 80 years after the return of the Jews under Cyrus. So here we see another group. Okay, we have a group under Zerubbabel. We have a group that's probably later under Nehemiah, a smaller group. And then we have this group here under Ezra that comes to Jerusalem. And why? Why did Artaxerxes send Ezra to Jerusalem? Verse 19. This is Artaxerxes giving command, you see, from verse 13 on through verse 26, giving instructions to Ezra on why he's sending him to Jerusalem. And he says, deliver to the God of Jerusalem all of the articles entrusted to you for worship in the temple of your God, and anything else needed for the temple of your God that you may have occasion to supply, you may provide from the royal treasury. Okay? So he sent some valuable temple articles, but also said, if you need anything else, I got an open checkbook here for you. Okay? Verse 25, and you, Ezra, in accordance with the wisdom of your God which you possess, appoint magistrates and judges to administer justice to all the people of Trans-Euphrates, all who know the laws of your God, and you are to teach any who do not know them. Whoever does not obey the law of your God and the law of the king must surely be punished by death, banishment, confiscation of property, or imprisonment. So he sent Ezra to teach the law to the Jews as well as to enforce the law. Okay? So he went to outfit the temple to teach and to execute God's law. And he was given the power to do all that. Now, you see, this is, it sounds like Artaxerxes is a Jew here, right? Well, you know, why is he going out of his way for the Jews like this? Go back to verse 23. It says, whatever the God of heaven has prescribed, let it be done with diligence for the temple of the God of heaven. Why should there be any wrath against the realm of the king and of his sons? So Artaxerxes was concerned about pleasing Yahweh. And he probably did this with some of the other peoples and their gods too. He wanted to please the gods so that the gods would look upon him with favor and his descendants. Okay, so he wanted to win the favor of the Jews' gods here. Well, before Ezra set out for Jerusalem, he had about 2,000 men and a whole bunch of riches with him that you see in chapter 8, okay, from verses 1 through verse 14. You've got all these different groups that are counted, and if you add them all up, you got around 2,000 men and lots of riches for the temple and money for whatever else he's going to need, all of that. And then before he takes off, what does he do? Verse 21, there by the Ahava Canal, so this is still in Babylon, I proclaimed a fast so that we might humble ourselves before our God and ask him for a safe journey for us and our children with all of our possessions. Okay, so they fasted. He had a 3-day fast to ask God for a safe journey. In verse 22, it says that he was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us from enemies on the road, because we had told the king the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him, for his great anger is against all those who forsake him. So, you know, I had told him that God was going to protect us and take care of us, so I didn't feel good asking him for help and asking him for protection, so I didn't ask for protection. So, before we left, I had everybody fast for 3 days and pray to God, and pray that God would protect us. Okay? So they go, and they get there safely. God does protect them on their way. They get there, and this is Ezra. He's a scribe who's going to teach everybody the law, and the purpose is the Jews now are serious about following God's laws. They had 70 years of exile that they never thought that God would ever remove them from the promised land, but he did, to teach them this lesson. And they got the lesson that God is God, that Yahweh is God, that he wants them to be faithful, and they are to be faithful, and they're not to be unfaithful. So they've got a renewed fervor of faithfulness here. And Ezra is going to help teach them and make sure that they know the law, because they didn't have copies of the Bible like we do today. There were no printing presses. So he would teach them and help them learn how to live under God's commands. He gets there, and right away he finds out they're already screwing up. And you see that. Chapter 9, it says, after these things had been done, the leaders came to me and said, the people of Israel, including the priests and the Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites and Hittites and Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians, and Amorites. They have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, and have mingled the holy race with the peoples around them. And the leaders and officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. So the Jews had not stayed separate, and they had intermarried. And one thing that the Jews learned during the 70 years in the Think About It chair in Babylon, they had time to study the scriptures. They had time to look at things. And they saw, it was very clear to them, that looking back in Old Testament history, how clearly God had stated that they were not to intermix with other peoples. And how clearly it was that when people had done so, that they were led astray. And that was the reason God told them not to intermix, because they will lead you astray. And sure enough, that happened. And God was not pleased. And Ezra gets there, already this is happening. Okay? Already people are intermixing with the Jews are intermixing with other peoples. And that is a big, big problem. So, what do they do? Well, you can see an immediate response here of Ezra. It says, when I heard this, I tore my tunic and cloak, pulled hair from my head and beard, and sat down appalled. He was devastated that they would do something like this. Okay? And then he goes and he prays, and that's what you have in the rest of chapter 9. It's this prayer to God. What should we do? We're guilty of this, God. Forgive us for this guilt. And then they come together, and he calls the people together. And what do they decide to do? Verse 10 of chapter 10. Then Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, you've been unfaithful. you have married foreign women, adding to Israel's guilt. Now make confession to Yahweh, the God of your fathers, and do His will. Separate yourself from the peoples around you and from your foreign wives." The whole assembly responded with a loud voice, "You're right. We must do as you say." So they realize and recognize that they had done wrong by marrying foreign spouses. And they were called to get divorces, okay? Called to break up their families and remove these foreign wives from the community. Not just the wives, but you see in verse 3, it also said their children as well. And they said, yes, we need to do that. In verse 16, the exiles did as what was proposed, and they went through family by family and made sure that all the foreigners were removed. And by the first day, in verse 17 of the first month, they finished dealing with all the men who had married foreign women. So that crisis was taken care of. And you see, it created a very powerful, strong lesson for the Jews as they're trying to rebuild their life with God in the Promised Land again. And that stuck with them. And you can see how serious they were about staying away from foreigners, staying away from outsiders when Jesus' time came. Okay? Gentiles, the whole concept of bringing the gospel to the Gentiles was horrible. You don't have anything to do with foreigners. When Jesus stopped and talked to the Samaritan woman at the well, that was horrible that a Jew would do that. Most Jews wouldn't even go through Samaria. They would walk around it. Jesus went through it. He talked to a Samaritan, and it was to a woman. And plus, he was a rabbi. Rabbis never even spoke to women. And so he broke a lot of the barriers that they had set up around this idea of not intermixing with foreigners. Okay, foreigners who could lead you astray. So they got it, and they took it to heart here. All right? And then the other part of Ezra's job was in teaching the law. So going on to Nehemiah chapter 8, we see some of that. Verse 2, it says that, verse 1, it says, "When the seventh month came," there we see the seventh month again, "the Israelites had settled in their towns, all the people assembled as one man in the square before the water gate. They told Ezra the scribe to bring out the book of the law of Moses, which Yahweh had commanded for Israel. So on the first day of the seventh month, Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly, which was made up of men and women, and all who were able to understand. He read it aloud from daybreak until noon, as he faced the square before the water gate in the presence of the men, women, and others who could understand. And all the people listened attentively to the book of the law." So they came together, and he read the Bible to them. Okay, again, they didn't have copies, so they had to hear it. There weren't many copies. So Ezra, the people gathered together, and Ezra read the book of the law, the Bible, the Torah, to the people. Well, did the people really want to learn God's law, or were they just watching a show going on? Well, in verse 4, we see that Ezra stood on a high wooden platform built just for the occasion. He opened the book, verse 5. All the people could see him because he was standing above them. And as he opened it, the people all stood up. Ezra praised Yahweh, the great God, and all the people lifted their hands and responded, "Amen, amen." And then they bowed down and worshiped Yahweh with their faces to the ground. So you see, yes, they really wanted to learn God's law. They shouted amen, which means so be it. They agreed with it. They bowed down. They worshiped God as they heard the law. Okay. Now, the Bible was written in Hebrew, but at this time, they weren't speaking Hebrew. They were speaking Aramaic. This is a few generations after living in Babylon, where the language was Aramaic. So how did they understand since they didn't speak that language? Verse 8 says that they read from the book of the law of God, making it clear and giving the meaning so that the people could understand what was being read. And the they is the Levites, we see in verse 7. So the people listened to the law being read. They heard it. They understood it because the Levites translated it. And how did they respond when they realized what it really said and how they fit under that law, that they didn't, that they were breaking the law? Verse 9, then Nehemiah the governor, Ezra the priest and scribe, and the Levites who were instructing the people said to them all, "This day is sacred to Yahweh your God. Do not mourn or weep," because all the people had been weeping as they listened to the words of the law. They were convicted by their sin. They cried and they mourned when they heard the law and heard how they had broken the law and heard how their predecessors had broken the law. As time went on, it sank in later in the month. In chapter 9, on the 24th day of the same month, the Israelites gathered together, fasting and wearing sackcloth and having dust on their heads. So they went into mourning. They were greatly moved and convicted by their sins. Verse 2, though those of Israelite descent had separated themselves from all foreigners, they stood in their places and confessed their sins and the wickedness of their fathers. They stood where they were and read from the book of the law of Yahweh their God for a quarter of the day and spent another quarter in confession and in worshiping Yahweh their God. Okay? So they were greatly moved. They confessed their sins. They worshiped God. Okay? They committed themselves. And that's what we see in the rest of the chapter here. Verse 38, it says, in view of all this, we, the people of Israel, the Jews, are making a binding agreement. We're putting it in writing. And our leaders, our Levites, and our priests are affixing their seals to it. And it goes on and lists a bunch of people who signed this. Okay, kind of like the Declaration of Independence. All the leaders here signed it. And going on, verse 29 of chapter 10 says, all these now join their brothers, the nobles, and bind themselves with a curse and an oath to follow the law of God given through Moses, the servant of God, and to obey carefully all the commands, regulations, and decrees of Yahweh our Lord. So they rededicated themselves. They made an oath to keep God's laws and promised themselves and swore themselves and bound themselves with an oath and a curse that they would be faithful. And we will see how that continues when we talk about what happens after the Old Testament in next week's lesson. Let's pray. God our Father, we thank you for the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah, seeing that these men of faith trusted in you. They put their necks on the line when they traveled to Jerusalem, left the plush comforts of Babylon and the Persian government and the Persian Empire, and went to the ruinous place of Jerusalem to rebuild it. Also, the people who went under Zerubbabel did so as well. And we thank you for showing us their examples of faith, their examples of dedication to you. Forgive us when we fall short of committing ourselves to you in much simpler acts that don't require a major change of our lifestyle and the change of where we live. Thank you for those examples and empower us by them. In Christ's name, amen.